Mr. Sherwood, Rule 12, we were talking about when you were taking a course at the Middle East School of Military Intelligence at Gaza in Palestine, and you just got this German anti-tank gun ready to fire, and it actually had a live shell in. Which
a live shell, which it shouldn't have had, but it did, and we warned the fellow, go through the drill, but then fire. Well, he went through the drill, which he knew, and there's a whole procedure, word, phrase after phrase after phrase, said by different people, and then it finished up with fire. I think that was what I think is a fire. So it's an automatic fire, you know, and the shell went off. And this was in a comparative built up area. It went right through a hut where a number of Egyptian workmen were sitting there having their lunch. But very luckily, it went right through mist everywhere. It came out the other end and went off somewhere into fields and exploded. But and we hushed that up. Because if there had been a court martial, we would have been in trouble. I'm afraid hashing up things was quite a practice.
Now, when were you doing this course? This would be
what period?
Roughly.
I can check it. So it would be, I'd say, in the early 44. Yep, about 44, 1944.
Yeah. And what else were you doing? Do any other memories of that course at Gaza?
Well, running these courses, I'd never run a course before, and I had to sort of just make up a course. And sometimes I felt a bit embarrassed because some of the people that I was teaching had been much more involved with the sort of thing I was talking about than I had. And even later on, some later stage, still, of course, I was giving talks on V1 and V2, the bombs that were coming over London towards the end of the war. And I was giving lectures about them, because I learned how this worked. And some of the people had been at the receiving end of their work. I was just talking academically about it. Also, Gaza, Palestine, staff at the school chiefly were Palestinian ATS girls. Jewish girls, entirely at the team, they were in Arab ATS, not sure, I don't think so. There were two Palestinian Jewish ATS girls in our unit. And subsequently, after the war, I learned, and they had to meet up with you because they were connected with somebody or other, that wanted to Haganah, that the underground army, because already it was getting into the end of the war, things were starting to move. The Haganah had told somehow maneuvered that they would be put in various units. These guys were more or less Haganah units of Haganah as well, so they learned how to run military matters. The same way that the Jewish Brigade, about that time, was formed. I wasn't directly involved with Jewish Brigade, except, again, as I said, we used to train various units, or intelligence units. There was intelligence units in the Jewish Brigade, and they would also come along, and we'd teach them about the enemy equipment. Jewish Brigade was formed when they were in Italy, and there were some fantastic stories about how they assisted refugees to the territories in Europe. Some of the stories are just unbelievable. The book's called Secret Roads. You know, because I don't know if you've seen the film Exodus, the chap pretended to be a British officer on the officer and got away with it. Well, I knew somebody who was the first Jewish regimental sergeant major in Reading. He lived in the same block of flats that I lived one time. And his story is fantastic. I'll give you one example of it. Amusing. Into his unit would come a lorry, and if something was wrong with it, he'd make a quick check, and let's say this was a Thursday, and say he knew I could fix this by 12 morning, but he said, can't get this down until sort of the middle of next week sometime, come along Wednesday next week. He said, okay, went away. They fixed the lorry the next day, and off it would go into Austria and Germany, pick up refugees from concentration camps, take them usually to La Spezia, that was the port of exit in Italy, to get onto ships to go to Palestine. part against. Of course, the British, well, they were against the British orders, and they had a lot of trouble when they were on the lake and stuff. But that was some of the sort of things that were happening to assist the refugees.
After the war had ended?
That did affect the war had ended. I think really it was after the war had ended, or about that time, that it was going to end. There were you had the meetings in Tehran with Roosevelt, and this was before the atom bomb. About the same time. The atom bomb was in.
So you were still at.
Still military intelligence, to about the mid part of 44, maybe a bit later, towards the end. Because then, even then, that school of military intelligence was starting to close down. In fact, the war must have ended while I was still there, because I remember when the night the war came to an end, all the guns were taken out and lined up along the coast of Palestine there, and a particular signal, they all started firing as fast as possible. Equivalent of a firework display that went off ages firing into the.
And that was on VE Day.
No, so that'd be
May.
E Day, not yes. VJ Day.
Yes, so that'd be 8th of May 1945, right about then.
Yes, that's been about then. That's right, because.
And how did you feel when VE Day came?
I remember I was. We knew it was going to happen. It was just a question of. When. And I remember our intelligence people saying the Germans don't have any more active units, any more regiments. It's all completely disintegrated. And it's just a question of today or next week or whatever. That's so obviously good thing. It came to an end. But it did also create other things, but this was actually a little later back in England. Because in the mess, detected a number of officers who were sorry that the war had come to an end, because they realised that they had to go into civilian life. They would lose the authority of being an officer, being a captain or major, and all that gave them, and they'd have to take their place fighting in civilian life, for which they weren't necessarily. And I certainly detected by then many people were saying, not many, a number of officers I remember saying, because already things were getting a bit difficult with the Russians, they anticipated that we shouldn't, now we're here, let's have a go at the Russians, wipe them out, and finish it all off. It was that's what the talk on me, sitting on that sort of thing. Anyway, back to the School of Military Intelligence. The social life at that time also was very, very good, but also there was the rumbling starting with problems of the Hirgun, the Stern Gang. There were these terrible things happening, not only just bombs on railway lines, but also blowing up the King David Hotel. And also there was a terrible thing when some of the Stern Gang people was hanged to British sergeant.
How did you feel about the whole question of Israel, Palestine, and the legitimacy of, say, the Stern Gang, people like that?
It was difficult. No, I had no sympathy whatsoever for the people like the Stern Gang. I did for people like the Haganah, who were sort of carrying on what seemed to be a legitimate way of trying to get independence. But no, the Stern Gang and the Irgun side of Idemi were doing things particularly. Harming innocent people who may be in the army, but they're in the army because they have to be in the army. I didn't approve of that at all. But I was in a bit of a difficulty, and in fact, this sort of arose. I was confronted with it on one occasion. This must be at the School of Military Intelligence in Gaza. I was called in to the G2 one day, second commander, whatever you call it. And he said, "Oh, Sherwood, I've got a job for you." "Yes, sir." "He wanted me to take on the job of being military liaison officer for the south of Palestine with the local police."
The Palestine Police.
Palestine Police. I was just trying to find out what are the job description, so to speak, didn't call it that. It was to liaise with the police in the event of any problems with the Sinhala or the equivalent, Sengen, and if necessary, to bring in the army to support the police. So I said, well, thank you very much, but realise I am Jewish. He said, no, he didn't know I was Jewish. I hadn't done the research very well, different records as well. So I said, well, I carried out my duty as well as I could, but you ought to know that I am Jewish before you make a decision. And he said, well, think about it, let you know. I went back and I told him the other chap was doing a similar job to me, non-Jewish. So I said, you've got a job, no job, because he was caught in a few hours later and given that job. And I was thinking back, should I have taken that job? Could I have done it? What would have happened if, I don't know, after all, some of the people that I was, I knew, I didn't know what they were doing or whether they were actively in Haganah or whatever, but the chances were that they were, some of them were. And how would I feel, blah, 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 and would I be able to do the job back really? And I thought, better off not doing it. Of course, if I were convinced that the Stern Gang or whatever were there, maybe I think, oh, good thing, I'll be an undercover for a representative, so to speak, in a high position. But I wasn't. I was interested in Zionism. I thought it was a very good idea for what was happening in Europe. And the question that they needed a home to go to, the work they'd already done in converting Palestine into a larger, green and pleasant, bringing in institutions which are both Western institutions, and which of course created problems, because it was a Middle Eastern country, and then we had a Western, and that being part of the problem, of course. In those days, the American element, well, there was American Jewish organizations who were helping, but it wasn't the same sort of political thing. Now, of course, Israel is considered to be the tool of America, the Satan America, that type of thing. But I didn't come across many instances, but I remember one particular instance. I was with this friend Benedict, walking the streets of Jerusalem, and there were a couple of British soldiers, not officers, very fanciers, and they passed a grocery shop, where fruit, oranges were laid out, something like that. And they just picked up one like that, didn't buy it or anything. And as they went by, the owner of the shop, who was there, nearly threw it at him contemptuously, you can imagine. And it was done in such a contemptuous way that I pulled them up, I told them off roundly, blah, 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 and sent them back to their unit, blah, 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 that sort of thing. And that was actually, I think, well, it's typical of part of the problem, and I think I know what the large part of the problem was. It wasn't so much political. The Palestine police disliked it intensely. They weren't, there was nothing like the British police. Any people from Palestine come to England, see the way the British police play. They couldn't believe that they were the same police force as the Palestinian police. But I can also understand why the Palestinian police were like that. Doesn't excuse it, but I understand why. The local Arab population in the Middle East were very subservient. Yes, sir. Of course, sir. Yes, sir. Of course, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The Jews in Palestine weren't quite like that. They were polite, and ready to be on equal terms, but they weren't ready to do all the yes, sir, yes, sir, of course, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. They would go have their say. If they disagreed, they'd say, oh, I don't agree with that, sir, which the Arab would never think of doing. And I think that must have annoyed the police, who considered, by and large, we were superior to the local Middle Eastern people. Didn't realize that in many ways any of the Jews who were in Palestine had educational levels and cultural and artistic levels way above, say, what the normal Palestinian policemen would have. They realized that we were lumped together. So that would create a bit of a problem also. There was no doubt Haganah were causing a lot of damage, and there were fights and war. arms that were being hidden, and when they were discovered, the people in the kibbutz or wherever, where the arms were found, would be shoved into jail, and that would create resentment, and then people would go out and take it out on some of the local police or the local army. So it's built up. And it was very difficult. I left.
How did you, when, I mean, did most of your fellow officers not realise you were Jewish then? I mean, this.
I think they did. I didn't actively go and say I'm Jewish, but when there were conversations, when it would come out, I was Jewish. They were all there. Some Jewish. I have another friend who lives in France now, a chap who was wounded in Italy, and got me mentioned in dispatches. He and his unit, when they were going to Palestine, I think someone who was staying in Palestine, he was asked whether, as he was Jewish, that he should not be posted to Palestine. There was that, apparently. But nobody I'm aware of held it against me. They
not even when there were sort of the attacks and
Well, when I was in hospital once, and I was going to have a note of that in the diary, the hospital, I think, was jaundice. I think around about that period. And, oh yes, also, that was tricky. Lord Moyne, does that mean anything to you? No. Lord Moyne was the Middle East representative of the British representative in the Middle East, based in Cairo. And it subsequently transpired that he was about to institute a system which would be a terrible blow to the developing Jewish community in Palestine, and he was assassinated by the Stern gang. And that caused a terrible outcry, and in the army, before lumping together all the Jews who had been responsible for it, except, and again I have a note, that some the officers were, well, come lump together, they understand this sort of thing happens, and you can't blame everybody for what they do and so on. But then I remember one of the other officers in the hospital railing against the general anti-Semitic remarks, usually saying, oh, they never in the army, don't do that job and that sort of thing. And I had a go at him and his officer, and I was Jewish. I hadn't come across very much overt anti-Semitism. There was a lot of overt, so to call it, sense when people were talking, someone said, oh, I'm not Jewish, that sort of thing. And it would lie, but then what do? How do you argue against that? What can you say? We, of course, if you've not many of go into an argument, it's a dead end. So often one would just keep quiet and let it slide. Felt a bit bad about it, but as a war, what's the use? Because there were lots of comments like that. Not very much. You don't get any minority with the wogs, or the Greeks, or all that sort of thing. What do you expect with the Greek? That type of thing. There was some quite a bit of that. And the time in Palestine then was getting a bit tricky. Also, there was one other occasion when I went to Bishop Benedict. My son lived in there, but he was working in a research centre, agricultural research centre, a place called La Follette. There was the Weizmann Institute, which has since done apparently fantastic research work. And I then I stayed overnight in some sort of hostel where people go and maybe four beds, mattresses lined up, lying in the room. And I was in uniform, and there was a storm, big storm, thunderstorm. And I went in, and I went in quietly to wake people. And I was standing near where my bed would be. Suddenly, one of the shutters crashed close in the wind. Perfect bang! And everybody got up. What's that? What's that? Shouldn't have ended, I suppose. Among them would have been some, well, I don't know, members or whatever it is. And I thought, oh, God, that happened. They think there's a raid. I'm there in uniform. And with the lightning, they could see that I'm in British uniform at my last moment. So I just knew a few words of Hebrew. Called the seder, told them, yes, everything's all right, called the seder, and they went back to sleep. And, oh, thank God for that. But it was a bit tricky. But then, I'm probably missing out on a lot of things that could say about it, but I can't recall them at the moment. But the time in Palestine was drawing to an end. The war was, I think, then at an end in where are we now, mid
45.
45, that's right. The Japanese war was still going on, of course. And the interesting thing about that is that units were coming from Italy or whatever, staging in Palestine, and they weren't sure whether they were going on to Burma. And the one thing that units did not want to do was go on to Burma. The horror for the war was terrible. And I had a friend of mine who's now in France now, who I've known him since childhood. I contacted his unit, who were in Palestine. He hadn't yet joined them because he was still in hospital in Tunisia. But I went there, and I was invited to lunch. Didn't make the lecture going off, the VIP treatment. I realized why they were in the VIP treatment, because they thought, well, I was an intelligence, I would know whether they're going on to Burma. But I didn't know. I didn't know that. But they thought that I was being very cagey and not telling them. They did not want to go on to Burma. And then when I saw them again sometime later, the little chap, Marmot, had arrived. I went along and went along on a motorbike, and he got leave, got in, off. He was a sergeant at that time. And we went off, he was on the back seat of the motorbike, and we drove off, spent time in Jerusalem. Oh, it's a horse. I was on a latrine somewhere in Gaza, Rose Field and offices and all that. And I heard an officer next to me saying to the chap who was, oh, I'm going to be in Jerusalem for a day. Is there anything there I could see? You know, what could I do with it? I have to spend a day in Jerusalem. What can I do there? And I thought, oh my God, what can you do in Jerusalem for a day? If you were there for a month, there'd be loads to do and see. But that's a pity if you don't do like that. Also, incidentally, on that thing, a thing I always regret is that I didn't take the opportunity to go to Petra. I could have, I think, organized somehow. It would be difficult because there was no, it wasn't organized like today. I've been to Petra subsequently. It's still hard, but you could do it. In those days, we could have done it because we could come out and get on with the chief and a few others and go off, and there was no border controls or anything like that. And I always, for years, decades, thought, why didn't I go to Petra? But finally, I managed to do it. And it was a job, it's very tough. Have you ever been? Okay. Right, we're now about the end of the war in Europe and the end of my period in that part of Palestine, that part of the Middle East. I was then posted, I went back to base depot for some reason, I think the school was closed down. And again, I was called for an interview with the Claims Commission. I think by that time, through Cairo, by that time, as I had a legal training, and incidentally, I'd been involved in quite a few court martials previously, you know, the period running up to.
What do you remember of that before we go on?
Court martials. Quite a few. I was defending at times, and I was on the court martial board itself. When I was defending, I remember defending a captain who was charged with using mess funds. And also was indecently assaulting a young girl, a child, a girl, about 7 or 8, in the house where he was billeted. I think I remember thinking back to some of the questions that I asked on the indecent assault part, very risky. We went at the bar, I went late to the bar. I realised you don't ask questions like that because you get the wrong answer, you're finished. And I remember thinking back to some of the questions I'd asked. The answers, fortunately, were what I wanted, but you don't do that sort of thing, it's too risky. Anyway, he was found not guilty on that, but guilty on the money. So he spent the money on a cabaret girl in Taipei or something, a Cairo cabaret girl. I got what the penalty was, I don't know for that time later. I was also on the court martial law itself, board case. It was interesting. There was
When you say you were on it, the board.
A member of the court.
Yeah.
Member of one of the judges, so to speak. There would have been four. One was judge advocate in the legal department. He was professional, and there would be another officer, me, maybe the three of us, and I was the junior officer. And the case was of three East African soldiers, black, who were charged with raping the West Air Force woman from the Air Force. You're an English girl. Two things about it I remember particularly. One, when evidence was given by a tracker, that's a local Egyptian, was able to follow footsteps and so on. And he said, yes, he heard that there were three sets of footsteps and he followed them to prison. And he said, he asked, how do you know there were three sets of footsteps? And well, I was told that there were three men involved. Oh, yes. And then they were found guilty. I said, I thought, no, the evidence is too slight, too difficult, and on the evidence anyway, it would be not guilty. Not necessarily innocent, but not guilty. But yes, not guilty. And then there was the sentencing. And the others were going for certain sentences, and I said, well, if we've got to assume that they're guilty of it, it was a terrible thing to do the way it was done. It's terrible. The punishment should be much harder than you're suggesting. So it was really a reversal. On one hand, I'd say they should be let off, but then I was saying, no, they should be punished that much more on the assumption that they are guilty. Also, in that case, there were three lawyers defending. And I think the courts were rather hard on them. I think there were three American Jewish fellows who probably would be studying law in America. They were defending. I remember the court, we called them Freeman, Hardy and Willis. That mean anything to you? Freeman, Hardy and Willis? That's why the name we get all given. And I think the court also felt that they were sort of clever Jewish lawyers. And, I had it down on them. I remember one particular instance when one of the lawyers was objecting to something or other, some evidence being held, and he was told, no, sit down. And he sat down, his side husband sat down, didn't carry it on anymore. And I remember thinking at the time that he didn't continue the argument because he was Jewish. He knew they were Jewish, and if he tried to continue the argument, it would have been all the words, and we had to shut up. And again, I think, yeah, I remember I was early 20s, an idealist in some ways. I thought, also, that's quite wrong. It should be like that, but that's how it happened. There were probably several court arguments, but there were two that come to mind particularly.
Do you think it was a fair system?
Yes. I think it was fair. I wasn't on cases where there were things like deserters, where apparently the deserter found guilty just to encourage the rest, that type of thing. The legal system was fair. It was weighted very much in favour of the defendant. If there was any doubt, you were supposed to, anyway, give it to the benefit of the doubt to the defendant. Personal prejudice that obviously came in, but then you had, as the head of a court martial, sometimes it was very grave grades of court martials. One would be, say, by the battery commander or by the regimental commander. But there was a big one, these were, where there was the judge advocate general department, and they were professional lawyers. So I felt that they carried out the military law according to the book, kept according to the book. And I think, yes, it probably was reasonably fair as it would be in civilian life. Except, of course, in civilian life, you might get more professional defence lawyers.